Hello and welcome to another episode of Mere Fidelity, where we have conversations about life, theology, and the church and the culture. My name is Derek Schmowey, and I'm joined by most of the cast and crew as usual. Matthew Lee Anderson, Andrew Wilson joins us, but most importantly, we have a special guest today. Dr. Todd Billings is back on the show. He is a professor of Reformed Theology at Western Theological Seminary, author of many of our favorite books, Union with Christ, Rejoicing and Lament, and most recently just came out, it's a new book, Remembrance, Communion, and Hope, Rediscovering the Gospel at the Lord's Table. And we'll get to that in a bit, but we wanted to open, well, first by saying hello, welcome to the show, Todd.
Yeah, it's great glad to be have with you. This is one of my favorite podcasts. So.
Excellent. We will put that on our iTunes reviews, which if you haven't reviewed us lately or never have, it's a little tip. You may want to review us.
All right.
But not I'm general listeners. But what I wanted to open up with, I can hear Matt snickering in the background, is you came out with, you had an article in CT online recently called The New View of Heaven is Too Small. And the subhead is Our Recent Emphasis on Kingdom Work Misses the Real Hope of the Afterlife. And that was an intriguing one, got shared around, sparked some conversation. So I want to actually start there and talk to you about the new view of heaven and why you find it cramped, why you find it problematic, as the kids say. So if you're okay with that, just as a quick explanation, how would you describe the new view of heaven? And then we'll go from there. That you're objecting to.
Yeah. Well, I think it's basically a certain type of Kuyperian or Neo-Calvinist view of heaven that puts a lot of emphasis upon heaven as the restoration of creation. And I'm all good with that, actually. It's responding to especially tends to respond to a form of dispensationalism where redemption means being delivered from the earth, and instead wants to make this basic point that redemption is the restoration of God's good creation. But what I've found is that particularly as this has hit more popular circles, I think it goes too far in losing some of the glory and the mystery of heaven and really the God-centeredness of heaven. For example, with others who take this up, generally you hear very little about the beatific vision or the way in which we are transformed in the vision of God in our worship of Jesus Christ. It's a frequent ploy of this approach to say, you know, heaven is not a worship service. And usually what it's said instead is basically heaven is going out and doing a bunch of tasks, going and doing a bunch of work, because this is what God created for us for in the garden. And so this is what we are being restored to. And so I've run into a lot of pastors and seminarians that have basically embraced this view. Often they get it from N.T. Wright, Surprised by Hope, and there's other sources as well. And what's interesting is that even though N.T. Wright has a much more nuanced view in many ways, the congregations end up not talking about the age to come hardly at all. Oftentimes it's like, well, the kingdom of God is here, and that's what really matters. And the age that is to come, it's basically going to be kind of like more of the same of the good stuff. Specifically what I take up N.T. Wright with is, you know, I have great respect for N.T. Wright. I've learned a ton from him, and there's all sorts of wonderful correctives in Surprised by Hope. But I think it goes overboard in certain ways. I think it often caricatures the historic Christian tradition in terms of its account of Christian hope. But specifically on, he gives an interpretation of 1 Corinthians 15, 58, where everything that you do for the Lord is basically a foretaste of the age to come. And he actually comes back to this multiple times in Surprised by Hope. So basically, he talks about that those as real and effective signs of the new creation, which is actually sacramental language, but he includes, you know, not just preaching, but here's his list: singing, sewing, praying. I'm sure for Alistair, he would include knitting and perhaps cake baking.
Todd getting in on it. Yes. Mock him. Get him.
But anyway, I just have found that that's actually a really, really unhelpful thing to say. Because even though all that we do is for the glory of God, if as I've walked along the dying, particularly in the last couple of years, have had a lot of circumstances for that, we're already obsessed with our own work. We're already obsessed with our identity in terms of what we can do. And that's precisely what people are losing when they are dying. They're losing one capacity after another. And rather than say, hey, you'll be able to run and, you know, run around and play football again or something like that, I think that we need to look actually to the way that baptism and the Lord's Supper and the preaching of the gospel itself lead us to anticipate the age to come, which is always about Jesus Christ at the center. It's always empowered by the Spirit. It's embodied. It's not just ethereal, but it is ultimately in a mode of worship. And our identities are in Him and in this covenant relationship, not simply, you know, getting to do all the things that we didn't get to do in this short life. So I don't know if that's a kind of a start or an entry point for some of your thoughts.
Yeah, that's perfect. Well, I have, as Matt would say, I have many questions, which I don't normally actually, but I'm really interested in. I'm trying to disentangle them as you're speaking, Todd, because I love the article and I think I'd almost entirely agree with it. But it's always the almost that makes these conversations interesting. I'm just looking at, as you're talking, I went to turn to the page on when in my sort of historical theology lectures where I do it, you know, basically what's the age to come like in the Christian imagination. I have four headings of the beatific vision, the defeat of evil, the renewal of humanity, and new creation. And I feel like in some ways the new creation and defeat of evil components are very clear in some of the work of someone like Wright. The renewal of humanity is there, but is more gradualized from where we are now, which is probably okay. And the beatific vision definitely is less emphasized and would probably have been the most emphasized for at least 1,000 years of the last 2,000, probably longer. And so I found that was quite a, to me, that's a very helpful corrective. And I certainly think there's an overcorrection. I probably see less of the overcorrection in my church world than you do. And that just probably reflects context. So in some ways, I still encounter quite a lot of people for whom Wright's corrective is, you know, to take Luther's horse, they're more likely to be falling off on the floaty ethereal vision side of the horse than they are on the, no, everything you do now, every house you build is going to be part of the new creation side of the horse. So I think it sometimes is just a reading of context, isn't it, as to how far you think a corrective needs to be issued and to what extent you think Wright's distortion as a counter-reaction is a necessary evil to stop people going too far the other way. But I definitely think it, you know, the idea, I suppose, of those different categories, the idea that I find the wedding image very powerful in Scripture, where if the idea of us coming together for a wedding, the actual, if anything other than the bride seeing the groom is if that's transcended by the joy of having a meal or the joy of having a celebration or having a party, then you've clearly missed the point of what the wedding is, that in that sense, there is a central focus to the eschatological you know, hope, and it's not the fact that the furniture has been restored or that the earth has been restored, although that is still gloriously true and is beautifully expressed in people like Lewis, but that actually there's more, that's ultimately not the focus. So all of that I think is very, very helpful. I'm interested by your, by the idea that I think there is a sort of significant drawback to people seeing their work in the Lord as continuing. And I want to just like to sort of, not that that's a focus particularly that I've made, but I think you said something just now, like, I don't want you to be thinking about the fact that you can run around and play football in the new creation. I think it needs to be more sacramental. And I think I'd probably agree with the affirmation, and I'd want to understand why the denial was there, because I think the idea of the liberation of creation from decay and despair and the incorruptibility of the body are quite significant themes in 1 Corinthians 15 and Romans 8. And I'm just interested, could you just elaborate on why are you in danger of overreacting to right, just as he's overreacted to Victorian eschatology or whatever it may be? So that's what I had that question. And then there's just one other thing if I throw in, because I don't know how long it'll be before I get to speak again. So that's question one. Question two, how much of the dilemma is created by the fact that in America, as I've observed it, the word heaven is used both of what I would call paradise and of what I would call new creation. So the intermediate state and the internal state. And even in a book like when Randy Alcorn is trying to champion the idea of a physical new creation, he still calls the book heaven because everyone in America does. Whereas here we would pass that a bit more. And often you'd hear people talk about paradise or where you go when you die versus the new creation. And I don't know how much that word is actually causing us a lot of problems on its own. I wondered if you could comment on that as well.
Yeah, maybe I'll start with a second. I think that the word does cause problems. In the book, I unpack that much more directly and distinguish those much more clearly. I just didn't feel like in a short Christianity Today article, I wanted that to be the focus. But clearly, my focus, what I'm seeking to get at is the ultimate character, the ultimate cosmic character of resurrection and new creation, not in a sense simply intermediate state. But I think that it's much more than a linguistic problem, though, because, you know, at funerals, at least in the United States, I don't know how it is in the UK, but there's very rarely a sense that the person is with Christ, but something better is yet to come. You know, it's usually just spoken of in terms of the person is now in heaven. They're with grandma and grandpa. You know, they're able to run around and play football and, you know, that sort of thing. So I think some of the challenges, and this is something that I think N.T. Wright is quite aware of and concerned about, is how do we make the climax of the story what is truly the biblical climax of the story, which is the cosmic new creation where every knee bows to Jesus Christ. I think that there is good news with regard to the intermediate state. I mean, I think that Paul, even in Philippians 1, when he's speaking about whether it is better to continue in his ministry or to die and be with Christ, I think he's speaking about the intermediate state there. But the really, really good news is the one that we have a foretaste of at the Lord's Supper, at, you know, a foretaste of the wedding feast. And I think the way that you describe that, Andrew, is really helpful and is actually where I go with it a fair amount in the book. On the question, am I, you know, going too far on the other side? Well, you know, perhaps in my comment about running around playing football, maybe that was going
too far.
It
would have to be football with a round ball for this to be in any way.
Yeah, exactly. Going to be a new creation.
And football with the feet, actually. So you guys have neither a foot nor a ball involved in your game of football. So
yeah, it's definitely not the Platonic form of football. But I think it's,
we'll let that
for me,
slide,
it's much
Andrew.
More of the center versus the periphery. So, you know, I affirm the resurrection of the body. I affirm that in the new creation is communal. It's not just sort of the individual. I affirm that the person will no longer be, you know, suffering from the physical maladies which hold them down. So in that sense, I affirm, you know, yes, you can be running around, but like that's not really the central point of our hope. The central point of our hope is that Jesus is in heaven and we're going to be there with him. We're going to, you know, participate in his resurrection. We're going to be with our beloved, that, you know, our prayer, thy kingdom come, will come in fullness. And so so it's, I'm not meaning to deny any of the physical, you know, aspects in terms of the running around part. You know, we can talk about that. We can debate about the football part, but I mean, some of the football part is like, I mentioned in the article that in here in Michigan, it's very common for pastors to hear about all the great hunting that there's going to be in heaven. And that, you know, you'll be able to shoot a 39-point buck. And this often comes up at funerals, not from the pastors, but from, you know, people sort of bearing testimony. And so some of what makes me uncomfortable, at least with the football part, would be the same thing that feels misdirected about the hunting a 39 buck part, which is the point is not a personal paradise. And the point is not to just, you know, take whatever you love now and extend it on forever, a kind of a replay mode with even better bucks to shoot or something like that. The point is that our desires themselves will be healed, yes, yeah, and directed toward the source of our life, the God of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And so I think a few people misunderstood that part of the article where they thought that I was, you know, saying that N.T. Wright was suggesting that we should, you know, that we will be shooting bucks in heaven. And that's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that that's kind of a folk theology, or it's in the book I call it a functional theology that at least is very prominent in different forms in congregations that I have seen, where you just imagine the sort of things you like to do and then you project it into the future for heaven. And the very this worldly view of heaven that N.T. Wright and Middleton and now John Eldridge and others are advocating, it's not confrontational enough to really confront this almost, you know, narcissistic view of heaven where it's whatever I like to do now projected in the future. It's not causing people to think that they're shooting bucks in heaven, but it's not confronting them with the fact that actually, heaven is going to be about Jesus and being about worshiping the crucified and risen Lord, just like at the table. And it's going to be about, and you could make similar points with baptism and so on. Is that helpful?
Yeah, it's very helpful.
Todd, one of the things, it's hard for me to come up with a question because as you're talking, all I can think is, yes, yes, yes. This is so clearly right all the way through. You know, the recent passing of Billy Graham reminded me of an article, a really short blog post that I wrote 6 or 7 years ago after Graham had published an op-ed in the Washington Post that distilled his view of heaven. And what struck me at the time was the way in which Graham his order of priorities, as it were. So when Billy Graham spoke about heaven, he'd say, you know, the first and most important thing is that it's where the presence of God is. God is there. Mm-hmm. Second thing is there's no more tears, no more sorrow, no more suffering. And then the third thing is, it's where the presence of all your loved ones who believed in Jesus are. Like they're going to be there. And what struck me at the time was the almost the generational difference that represented, where you have, you know, Graham coming out of a social context in a milieu where family ties are very, very important. The nuclear family has a real high value. Whereas N.T. Wright is reaching into mostly a social context within the younger sort of crowd who have really latched onto his work, where family ties are secondary in some ways to career, vocation, etc.
That's an interesting point.
I think it's well, thank you, Andrew. Thank you.
It last happened last March, and I just thought I wanted to memorialize the moment with an intervention.
Oh, man.
That was so well played. It was almost like that compliment was just a setup for that joke.
I didn't know you were going to react that way, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. So, Todd, one of the things that I wonder about with respect to the question of emphasis and priority that you're talking about is the creed, right? So in both the Apostles and the Nicene Creed, there is no mention of the interim state, which has this beatific vision where you get the presence of God prior to the resurrection of the body. The ordering is, you know, we believe in the resurrection of the body and the life of the world to come, or the life everlasting. And I wonder how we should, as we think about ordering and priority and emphasis, how we should account for the fact that the creeds put the resurrection of the body prior to the life everlasting and just leave out any claim of an interim state at all?
Well, it seems like the most direct answer to that would be one that I'd have to look into in terms of, you know, what was assumed, what were the issues at stake at Nicaea related to that, and what issues just were taken for granted. I mean, I would guess that some notion of the interim state was taken for granted, but there's no question that not just for the creeds, but for the biblical narrative overall, the central Christian hope is what the creeds point to. It's not the interim state. And so, I ultimately want to connect those in that the interim state is hopeful precisely because the final new creation is going to be really, really glorious and hopeful. So it's a kind of appendage to it. It's almost parasitic to that. Or if you put it in terms of union with Christ, I mean, Paul suggests that in some sense, his union with Christ is going to be even deeper after his death. And at least how I read him, he is speaking about the interim state, but there's no question that the union with Christ is going to be most intimate and most glorious at the final new creation, when it's communal and cosmic and the kingdom has fully come. I mean, on the relatives part of your question, I mean, what I find interesting is that with the four points that you gave about Billy Graham and heaven, I think that in evangelical circles now, at least in some evangelical circles, some of the trends that I'm concerned about, you wouldn't necessarily have a clear prioritizing of the first few, even before you get to family. And so, again, I mean, one way would be, what is the center? What is the periphery? And that's some of why I want to go to the sort of ordinary means of grace, and as a foretaste of the age to come. But there is also an aspect of social class related to this. My wife, Rachel, she teaches part-time in Old Testament. She got her PhD with John Levinson at Harvard. And she was reading, a number of these authors, and a number of these authors, even in their understanding of Second Temple Judaism and apocalyptic literature there, she's like, whoa, this is like really strange. This is way too this worldly. I mean, in apocalyptic literature, they're not worrying about, you know, will I have enough projects to do in the afterlife? Or, you know, and she also seemed to think that this had something to do with, like, sort of middle-class men, in particular. Some of this, you know, huge emphasis upon work and the projects that we will be doing. I mean, if it's on the stage, I think on the periphery of even what the apocalyptic hope is about. And the hope is ultimately that the world as we see it is not the final word because of God's dramatic and incredible intervention. and you know, yes, it will be ultimately a restoration of God's good purposes and God's creational purposes. This is something where God is in the driver's seat. I mean, God is the central actor, and it's really not mainly about us wanting to, you know, continue to find fulfilling the sorts of things we've found fulfilling so far.
Todd, can I just ask you about one more thing that you
Sure.
mentioned in your previous talks that I think relates to this? You spoke some about the therapeutic value, the respective therapeutic value of each kind of vision, and what, as I'm thinking about the various social contexts in which this has emerged, you know, I recently, over the last few months, went through a very serious situation. We lost a family member. It was very difficult on everyone. And the thing that struck me was the "all fly away" motif, you know, heaven's coming, had an enormous therapeutic value for us in a way that the work project, new kingdom, did you know, new heavens, new earth motif didn't. In part because the intensity of the suffering cried for immediate alleviation and satisfaction, and not a slow unfolding of this creational life. And I mean, as you talk about some of the social context and some of the classism, I think probably one other reason why a view like N.T. Wright's has such strong cachet is just a significant like gap between a lot of the people who have adopted it and really like hard, very palpable suffering. And I'm intrigued about your own biography in this respect, because, you know, you've written about your own facing cancer, and you have the wonderful book on lament and grief. How much of your own biography has brought this issue to the surface, and has it been helpful therapeutically for you?
Yeah, I mean, that has definitely raised my awareness of it and just caused me to see things that I didn't see before, and in a variety of places. You know, just thinking about the example that you gave, it really reminds me of the Negro spirituals. And so how many of those Negro spirituals were just captivated with heaven in a way that would actually make a number of these authors quite uncomfortable, I think. And, you know, you could just write that off and say, well, it's just this, you know, otherworldly longing of a of an oppressed people. But I think it really was a deeper form of both lament that had an action, an activist part of it. I mean, it led them to action, but also just the sense, similar to with Jewish apocalyptic writers in some ways, that things are radically wrong with the world and we need God, and we need God at the center. We don't just need God to sort of tinker with a few things around the edges. we desperately need God at the center. We need God's intervention. And so, I mean, on my own level, this isn't going to sound, I think, very profound, but I struggle a lot with fatigue because of my chemotherapy. And so, like, I'm always having to think about my energy levels and that sort of thing. And so I found that after that experience, you know, just reading some of these authors just made me tired. It's like, oh, I don't need another project, you know, like, I want some rest. I want some Sabbath, you know. Isn't Sabbath in there somewhere, you know? Also I've made it a practice, especially in the last 2 years when I've been doing some work on a book project that just I'm a few chapters in on cultivating resurrection hope in an age of medicalized dying. And so I've just tried to be with the dying in my congregation and be with people as they walk that path. And that especially has given me a sense that, like, a lot of the hymns and songs that, you know, Wright and Middleton are really uncomfortable with, I think are actually very appropriate a lot of times. And I mean, it was kind of odd because in the article I mentioned one person who I was walking with who, when I wrote the article, was still alive and not a Monkhannock, but right around he actually died right around the time that the article came out. And just, you know, the last time I was with him, I was with him with my 8-year-old daughter, and he was kind of moving out. He couldn't really interact with us, but we prayed the Lord's Prayer, which is what we would always do with him, and he was able to mouth it with us. And, you know, that's our hope, and that's his hope encapsulated there. It's about the drama of God bringing his kingdom in Jesus Christ and belonging to Jesus Christ as a son or daughter and being transformed by this glorious vision that is, you know, he did a great job fixing cars in his life. But it's going to be a lot bigger than anything like that. And so, yeah, I feel like I'm sort of falling short in terms of words, but yes, there is an existential side of it that I think helped me to see things I hadn't seen before.
Todd, I really appreciated that whole approach, and especially some of the development that you do have in your chapter on hope in Christ and the communion. The thing that struck me as I've been reading and studying more and more in studies here is the temple theme. And the that the temple is just the culmination of So much of the biblical storyline from, you know, the creation of the earth as a temple of God's glory and Adam as a priest king, and the way that the tabernacle and the temple are in a sense a return to Eden, a return to the purposes of the Lord, of dwelling and communing with the Lord. And then the final vision is of Jerusalem, the holy city, but it's a city as a temple, and where God is, God is central, right? That the it's new creation restored as a temple where, you know, who shall ascend to the mountain of the Lord? I mean, see God face to face. And I really so appreciate the theocentricity of that vision of heaven, and just really realizing how deeply earthed that is, deeply woven that is into the entire storyline, and just coming into the presence of the Lord. To bring it around to the book, I was just going to ask you, I mean, there, you'd go into a lot of other dimensions, you know, communion dimension, remembrance dimension, but this hope dimension of, you mentioned a couple of times, but the way that, I mean, you speak to the way that like a weekly communion or the practice of communion really, you see that confronting us now, and you see that drawing us in now, and reorienting us now towards our hope. Then, I mean, if you just speak to that for a minute or two, just the way the encounter with God in the supper, reorients us, I'd just love to hear a little bit more on that, if you would.
Yeah. So some of what I work with is, an image of the Lord's Supper as an icon of the gospel itself, as a kind of sign action that points us to the center of the Christian life. And so through the Lord's Supper, we encounter a gospel that is not, you know, simply forgiveness of sins. It's not less than that. Certainly involves that, but, you know, it also involves new life. It's involves being incorporated into God's work in the past, living in God's work, even as ones whose bodies do not belong to ourselves, and then living and even aching and lamenting even in hope as we look to the age to come. And I think that I agree with Calvin on this, that you can't really move deeply into that unless you have a frequent celebration of the supper, or it makes it very difficult to. And I guess the underlying issue is, do you see the Lord's Supper as nourishment? Or do you see it as simply like remembering something that happened a long time ago? You know, it might be possible to remember something that happened a long time ago too often, though, you know, if we're talking about the cross of Christ, I think that's doubtable, dubious. But to have, if this is a meal, a nourishment, which we actually need because we are embodied communal creatures, we need this nourishment, not just like a sermon on our podcast. We need this embodied communal nourishment, which shows forth the gospel of Jesus Christ. Then a frequent celebration seems to be in order. Now, I don't think that just celebrating frequently is going to solve all your problems, or, you know, necessarily make you a deeper Christian, or things like that. I don't at all frame it as a kind of panacea or something like that. But I think there is a way to move into a frequent celebration of the supper. And it may be, you know, for some congregations, it may be moving from quarterly to monthly, you know, but a frequent celebration of the supper that leads the congregation deeper into the gospel itself. I think a lot of pastors aren't quite sure like they know they should celebrate the supper, that it's important and significant, but like what is God doing through it? And in some sense, that's some of what my book explores. What is God doing through the supper as an instrument in the church? And how can we participate in that?
Thanks for that, Todd. I said there's so much more depths, so many more depths to plumb in the book. And so I would really do encourage our listeners to pick it up. Remembrance, Communion, Hope. We really did just scratch the surface of some of the themes in it. But this discussion was very helpful. I think just encouraging and helpful for those in ministry and those without just to think about what our real hope is, what we're really looking forward to. So, Todd, we just want to thank you for coming on the show and joining us. It was a blast.
Yeah, it's great to be with you.
All right. With that, faithful listeners, we will be back again soon. But in the meantime, there is a backlog of episodes. In case you're just wondering, what am I going to do with my life next now that this is the last episode that has happened while I'm listening to it? There are other episodes that you can go back and listen to and just fill the void of your life. Sorry, that was really intense as a plug. But with that, we're gonna sign off and say thanks for listening.